Who have you already used or made?
I'll wait till the recording starts and I'll say it.
It's already recorded, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I had my first Zelda me was Link, and then I waited a bit. I didn't want to like spam a bunch of Zelda characters. Then I added Zelda, and then recently I added Midna, like fully non-imp Midna, because it's kind of it'd be hard to manage that. So I made Twilight Midna. And I've had a hard time figuring out who else to add, especially in terms of guys, because I feel like there's not a whole lot of not a lot, a lot of standalone male Zelda characters that I could think of, at least, that I wouldn't want as part of like a bigger group. Maybe Ghirahim. I think Gav is get
Yeah.
some variety.
It's a
But I don't want anyone
Ghirahim.
else.
Beetle was the first one that came to my mind.
Beetle would be funny. Grus.
Yes.
That's true. I wonder if
Grus
there's
would
a
be.
good hairstyle for Groose.
I mean, any
Not gonna
kind of
not.
fauxhawk or pompadour, I feel like.
Yeah, it's they gotta have a pompadour hairstyle in there,
There
right?
is, but Groose's is like so pointy and sharp.
Well, that's because no one can pull off what Grus can pull off.
That's true, but I feel like I'd be doing a disservice to Groose if I made like a non-accurate hairstyle for him.
I mean, to
Assuming
be
you.
fair, there's but so much you can do in these.
I'm assuming a person can't just be a skeleton, so you can't do the hero shade from Twilight Princess, can you?
You
Like
can.
they have to have flesh on them, don't they?
That, yeah. But
Darn.
you could do the face paint feature and just,
Okay.
because
Yeah.
you can make a pretty blank face. You can just remove the nose, remove the ears, you do no mouth and just draw everything on.
The character creation seems pretty robust in that game.
Oh
From
yeah.
some of the stuff I've seen people do like on Twitter is nuts.
Oh yeah. The
It's
face paint
really
feature is
impressive.
really, really fun. Especially if you use it right in the proper ways, like matching the proportions and stuff. My most
Which Ganondorf are you going to
complex.
make?
Oh, good question.
See, that's a good one. I've been grappling with whether or not I want to do Ganondorf.
Why would you not want to do Ganondorf?
See, I know it's such a tangential, like, easy thing to do, but I'm like, I don't.
Do you have a limit on how many characters you can make?
I mean, the 70 is the max amount of Miis,
I
but
think you'd be fine throwing in a Ganondorf.
Do one of the
it's
Sheikah monks from Breath of the Wild.
I don't care about them,
Like
I'm gonna be
Maz
honest.
Kushea. Oh, come on.
I'm gonna be honest. I don't care. There is a hat that is almost perfect for the Sheikah monks.
Yeah, like the rice hat.
Yeah, but I could just do like Impa or Paya. I'll do Paya. I love
Paya.
Paya.
Yes,
Oh,
do
my God.
Paya. I need
But
dudes though.
she's not male, and that was your original
Yeah.
question.
Yeah, right? I'm trying to throw guys at you.
Ghirahim
Hang
is one of
on.
my top options. I'll do Ganondorf. I'll do Ganondorf. I don't know. I just didn't want to like throw a bunch of the obvious picks out there. I wanted to see if I can spice
Well,
it
you
up.
have one for each of them, and then you expand it to the other sets. Alfonso, Spirit Tracks.
I love Alfonso. Burn.
Isn't that just Gonzo?
Burn. Bjorn is great.
Alfonso is the descendant of
Right.
Gonzo.
Yeah.
What about Daphnis?
Nah,
Okay.
my
Well,
island doesn't need a king of Hyrule.
it's 'cause you're too busy ruling it yourself.
Yeah, my Miis call me Divine One.
That's
Oh, he
very
calls himself God, does he?
That's very humble
No,
of you.
I'm kidding. They call me
Fuck.
Boss. I'm kidding. They call me Boss.
You gotta make Sidon.
I tried making Sidon and Mipha, but I couldn't figure out the face paint for them.
Okay.
It was a lot.
Fair enough.
Is Cafe an option?
I guess.
That is a good
I
option.
guess.
Cafe Nanju.
Yeah.
Though I don't know what
Oh.
the height situation is with that
Right. Yeah.
game.
Do
You
you
can
want to
make
make
one,
the
obviously.
I could just headcanon Cafe pre-curse
Right.
form.
Or
Make him adult.
post-curse, because he does get
Hunky
healed.
adult
Yeah.
cafe.
Who we never see.
He's probably gorgeous.
Probably.
Honestly, I assume that his face and is the same. It's just his proportions get.
Well, I don't know.
I think the graphics that be in Majora's Mask make it really hard to. Is he just child Kafe, or is he adult face Kafe cursed, kind of like Midna is cursed with a weirdly proportionate body?
It's probably just a Link, adult Link, young Link situation.
Okay.
But like, does adult Kafe have like facial hair? We don't know.
Good question.
I could see him with some kind of like goatee, 5 o'clock shadow type deal. Oh gosh. Now we're trying to come up with hunky Kafe.
I know.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the Zelda Universe Podcast. We appreciate you taking the time to spend with us as we reminisce about our many adventures in the land of Hyrule and beyond. My name is Connor Schultz. It is a pleasure to be with you once again. And joining me, we have two of our returning guests. Caden, you're 2 for 2.
Oh, yeah. 2 in a row. First time ever. Happy to be here.
And welcoming back once again our features director? Features director, Jeff? Is that your official title?
That is correct.
That is okay. We throw titles around as if it actually matters, even though it really doesn't. It's just you want to be in charge of the thing? Awesome, cool. You are now the CEO of something. I don't know, I couldn't think of a thing.
Right, do you want to be director? Do you want to be boss? Whatever you want.
I think I'm technically the manager, according to my official thing of the podcast, so...
I don't even know if I have a title.
Contributor?
Like I said, man, whatever you want to be.
Musician? Yeah, come up with your own thing. You can be the maestro.
Associate music correspondent.
Excellent.
There we go.
Just remember, the coolness of your title is directly proportional to the number of syllables, so you're doing good.
This is true, yes.
Well, we're going to start today with a trip to Yuga's Gallery, the series in which we highlight our favorite artwork from the Legend of Zelda community, as well as some official artwork. But today, we are looking at a piece composed by an artist known as UFO Approached, who has brought forth a... honestly, amazing rendition of Marin from Link's Awakening. I picked up this one, because it's gorgeous as heck, but secondly, because I absolutely adore Marin, and I will take absolutely any excuse to talk about Marin. The theme here is a line from Marin's conversation with us when we have our little introductory date, our moment alone on the beach, where she gives us her dreams. This is a rare, at least up to this point in the franchise, a very rare personal insight into an NPC, where she wishes that she could be a seagull. So she could travel the world and sing for so many people.
It so makes me want to... It makes me really yearn for a full, like, animated series. Maybe not even an animated series, but, like, more cutscenes. Like, the intro cutscene in the remake, the Link's Awakening remake. Because when we first saw that in the reveal... I was so hopeful that there would be like more cutscenes like that. And we didn't get it. And then
we got one at the end.
Yeah. Very beginning, very end. And then when Echoes of Wisdom came out, I was like, oh, the Link's Awakening remake art style, please give us cutscenes like the intro. We got nothing. So I was really sad, but seeing this, I'm like, yeah, Marin is so cool. Like as just like as a concept within the Zelda universe, and everything around her is surrounding like the dream island thing for the story. It's just really cool. good theming.
That, or at least I would have loved official art that showed them in realistic proportions for Link's Awakening and Echoes of Wisdom, kind of like how the Oracle games had all of their official arts of the NPCs.
Right.
So that you got to see a full-size illustration of them as opposed to the, you know, little sprite characters that you see on screen. But this piece that we're highlighting, I mean, that would have been ideal for an official art of that. That is just gorgeous. It really is a fantastic piece.
I love Marin's position in the franchise as a whole. As really the first time where we have a real emotional resonance with any character in the franchise as a character. Up to this point, we've had Link to the Legend of Zelda, Adventure of Link, A Link to the Past. And as amazing as adventures as they are, they do not have the same kind of depth and soul in their characters. And that is where Link's Awakening as a whole shines and distinguishes itself from the other three games. And Marin in particular is the highlight of that, as we see her the most, and we get an insight into her hopes and dreams and personality unlike anything we'd ever seen up to this point.
It's cool that you bring that up, because I never really thought about it before now, that, like, yeah, for the first three Zelda games, you have characters, but not really in so much of, not so much as depth to those characters that I can think of, at least. Like, the most in-depth writing I could think of before Link's Awakening would have been, like, Link's uncle in Link to the Past, like, when he dies. But then, after that, I can't really think of anything else.
Right, there's really nobody who has, like, an exposition on their personal desires, their backstory, anything like that. You really don't get an insight into the way many NPCs think prior to Marin.
The closest thing that we get is Princess Zelda herself. There is a little bit, at least in the tone in which she speaks at the very beginning in her dream of, please help me, I'm imprisoned, all this stuff is happening, help me. There's a couple of other moments with her, but aside from, and honestly, aside from her and Sahasrara, the elder, everyone else is pretty cookie cutter. You could swap out any of them with each other and there would be no prominent difference, truly, aside from, okay, it makes no sense for a random Zora person to be the sick kid in bed who gives you the bug net or anything like that. The joy of Link's Awakening is they could not expand the world. This is a theme that we're going to be getting into when we get to our feature. They can't expand the world, so they expand the details within that world. And so suddenly, you can't switch any of these characters. Because that gator who wants the dog food, that doesn't make... It only makes sense for the gator with the dog food. Mr. Right only makes sense for Mr. Right. And so suddenly you have an ecosystem that feels so much more alive than anything we've had thus far, which is ironic in the fact that all of this is supposed to be some kind of dream. Something about the piece itself that drew my attention is the lighting that's put into this. It's surrounded by sparkles, which, aside from making it look super, super pretty, it also gives a very holy, kind of angelic feel to it. So even though those are supposed to be and are colored to be seagull feathers, they have a nigh angelic quality to them, which is a really brilliant touch.
And I think the sparkles in the lighting itself also adds to the, you know, the dream, the dream-based setting. And she's looking up. It's very hopeful. Like maybe there is something after the dream fades away. Very poetic.
As a fellow artist, I'm extremely jealous of their ability to draw hands so well too. Because if you know anything about drawing, hands are the absolute worst things to draw for a human being. So UFO Approach does a fantastic job with her fingers on here, the way they bend, the way they just lay out. Wish I could do that myself.
They look like actual hands.
Fingers are so tricky to draw when you're drawing people.
I mean, that was the big thing, like when Disney started getting into like Snow White and whatnot, the real crazy thing that was about that movie and things beyond it was the fact that it was a full-on hand.
Yeah, like realistic proportions, realistic movement, all that.
Exactly.
The joint movement.
Also the lighting on the hands too. It's really detailed.
The shadows.
Shadows.
All of those kinds of things.
Beautiful piece.
I have my blue sky primarily just to follow artists. My social media is just, ooh, look at the pretty pictures.
Mm-hmm. And not a bad thing to use social media for. I mean, that's about as wholesome as it gets nowadays.
You know, that's what I figured.
One of the best things, honestly.
And with that, and with looking at all the different art, it is fascinating as a person who has not invested time to develop my artistic skills. The things that people are able to do in paper drawing, particularly in computerized drawing, to render all of these pieces in the way that they do. I don't even understand fully what rendering means in an artistic sense. I just know it for putting all of the video clips and whatnot for the stuff that you will see here on the podcast. But to be able to create those kinds of intricate details, where is the light coming from and what effect does it have on the rest of the piece that you see? So now that I say that, what is interesting is that from what I can tell, all of the shadows are coming from Marin. It is Marin's hair, her clothing, her pendant. That's what's creating all of the shadows. There's not a single shadow coming from any of the feathers.
Mm.
It kind of adds to that ethereal nature to what the feathers are supposed to symbolize and how we treat this world that we are a part of, which actually leads me to an interesting question. One that I think most people have probably thought of at one point or another. Do you think Marin's dream comes true?
I like to think it does. Because the alternative, it's just sad.
It's the nihilism of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons why you never, as a rule, which this game breaks, you never make a whole journey or a significant development process nothing but a dream or in an imagined scenario or anything like that, because you eliminate it because it's a dream. None of it mattered. Nothing takes place. And so we don't care. But this is someone that we do care about. We develop this relationship with Marin. The date and learning about what she dreams about happens just a couple of dungeons before we learn about the true nature of Kalalint. And I know the manga does a really good job of illustrating the existential crisis that comes from something like that.
There is sort of like a feeling of dread that kind of builds up throughout the back half of Link's Awakening, because I feel like you as the player, you don't want it to be a dream. Like, you want to think that the whole thing is a ruse, that it was, I think Facade was the boss that outright tells you everything will disappear. Like, you want him to think they're lying. Like, you want it all to be real. And you're constantly asking yourself that question until the very end of the game, whether or not it's going to turn out to be true or not.
I appreciate the end game credits where if you go through without ever dying, you will see Marin in the sky as part of that ending cutscene. I don't know if that's true for the remake, but that was a thing that was present in the original where you only saw Marin if you got through without dying.
I think it is in the remake too. I think that same like requirement.
Okay. Because it does give you hope that maybe there was something about Marin's essence that lives on.
I think it also helps that the Islanders, as far as I'm aware, don't realize that they don't actually exist. And if they did, and it was really obvious that, okay, they know what's going on, so it wouldn't really impact the player as much. But the fact that they're unaware of it, but you, the player, and Link find out and have to pull the plug anyway, I think that all also circumvents the issue of, you know, it was a dream all along, because there is still like that internal dilemma. Oh, I don't want to have to do this, but I have to do this, but I don't want to.
Yes, that is what saves that premise, as it were. The fact that Link himself is real, and we know he is real because he continues on after. You talk about the villagers not knowing, and you are right. It reminded me that just the brilliance in storytelling of Link's Awakening. This is one of the reasons why this one has just grown in my estimation over the years of revisiting it. The things that a lot of the villagers will talk about, especially Papal's sons playing in the village, they will say things like, how do I know this? I don't know. I'm just a kid. It's like, well, you know this because the dream logic is consistent. How long have we been here? I don't know. Doesn't matter. But it should matter. But you don't. It's just all of these little hints that's like, no, something is not right here. And all of those hints build and build and build until here's the reveal. And then that curiosity and confusion turns to dread as it continues to build and build. And it's so good.
Would you love me if I were a seagull?
I would love Marin anywhere. And thank you so much, UFO Approached, for composing this a gorgeous piece. And thank you, Caitlin Druitt, for presenting us with this piece from Yuga's Art Gallery. And we're going to head on over to The Bomber's Notebook, a series where we take a special look at the various and unique characters found in The Legend of Zelda. And today, we are going to continue on the high seas as we move over to the Wind Waker, specifically to Outset Island, where we meet one of the residents of this island, a aged individual who, honestly, I rarely spend any time with. All of us are pretty much focused on Orca, the swordsman who gives us our own weapon before we set off on adventure. But Orca has a brother who lives upstairs. And he doesn't like how much Orca trains at all.
It's one of those characters that, you know, I just forget they have a name. And I enjoy that. It's the cranky old man trope that just yells at you from the balcony. I'm thinking of like Statler and Waldorf the Muppets. it's a fun trope.
Sturgeon's a great example of a character that shows that like the Wind Waker's art direction is more than just the cel-shaded graphics and, you know, vibrant colors. It's also that so many characters have unrealistic proportions. Like in Sturgeon's case, his head is nearly as tall as the rest of his body combined. So like his forehead is the same height as his hips down to his feet. Like stuff like that is so great and so memorable about Wind Waker's character design. Also some of like their monsters. Like if you look at like the Stalfos, their body proportions are so crazy. Like the hips are super wide. The one jaw is off to the side. It, like nothing about it makes any anatomical sense whatsoever.
Stalfos's in Wind Waker make me think they're like the Stalizifuls, except very, very like bigger. For some, they look like dinosaurs. They're dinofuls, except skeletons. No, the proportions in Wind Waker are absolutely hilarious. I realized as I was prepping for today that the reason why I never interact with Sturgeon is because he is the one who gives you the crash course and how all of the controls work. If you actually bother to go up into his room, he will meet with you and be like, I have compiled all this stuff from the course of me and my brother's adventures. Take a look at all the instructions on the wall and it will show you how to deal with items and well, he teaches you about targeting, but all of the other things. And if you have played enough of Zelda games up to this point, especially Majora's Mask and Ocarina of Time, there was no point. So why would you bother? I know how this game functions. They basically condensed every single instruction Navi ever gave us into one room and said, there, if you need it, fine. If not, go on your merry way.
They made it optional. I realized after reading this entry of the Bomber's Notebook, I didn't ever really complete the
figurine quest.
Oh, the Nintendo gallery?
Yeah, the gallery, yeah. The figurine gallery.
Likewise.
And I just learned that he used to be a swordsman. That's new info.
I never knew anything about that before this Bomber's Notebook entry, so I definitely learned something.
Both Sturgeon and Orca sailed the seas together for a time, and that's why Sturgeon has all of this information about how all of the controls work, and it's why Orca has the skills that he does. Just only one of them decided to continue on studying the blade. No shame for not completing the Nintendo Gallery. For those who are unaware, there is an area in one of the trees or islands sticking up next to the Great Forest Haven, where you can turn in pictograph pictures of people and get 3D models to look at and get some additional fun factoids about that. In the first original Wind Waker, you can only have one photo at a time.
I remember that.
So to turn in anything and complete this thing was a Herculean task of Sisyphusian proportions. And yeah, no.
The words I saw some people use to describe that quest back in the day cannot be repeated on this podcast. People hated that.
I have done it, but on the HD version, because then you have 3 photos that you can take, and that helps things immensely. Plus, you are given indications of what things you need to take pictures of. And if you miss taking a picture of, say, Goma, then you can go purchase that and bring it to the gallery to get the figure. So there are ways to do it. I wonder, how much of a relationship do you think the two of them have, Orca and Sturgeon? Because obviously Sturgeon is banging, keep it down.
I mean, they kind of live together, so like they have to say hi once in a while, I'd imagine.
Do they though? Because they have separate doors. It's like duplex.
If one of them ever leaves the house, which I imagine they do at some point.
Well, I mean, is the downstairs just the dojo, though? Is that Orca's room? Does he live down there?
I'm pretty sure that's Orca's room. I believe there is a hammock or something in there.
I don't think there's anywhere else you can, like, explore in there. I think it's just that one room.
I know Sturgeon has a bed in his room.
I like to think it's that their relationship is, you know, Orca is like the only person on the island that Sturgeon can tolerate. And he gets annoyed by the constant training, but like, you know, still his brother. He still loves his younger brother. But he's the only person that he'll like get a regular conversation to. I guess aside from Link, I guess, maybe. But even then.
There is a story there about their adventures, but also why they stopped adventuring. Like, did Sturgeon prevail upon Orca because of a situation? Maybe Orca nearly got killed, and Sturgeon is like, nope, can't have this happen anymore. I'm done. I'm not letting him get himself killed.
Maybe it's about the Dark Knights and the Knight's Crests.
Oh, that's true, because the Orca wanted those. Both of them were searching for them.
Theory time. They were adventuring. They got bested by some Dark Knights, and we're like, hey, nope, we're packing it up right now. We're done for now. And then that's why Link has to, you know, give them some Knight's Crests to give them some sort of peace of mind.
Actually, I did just remember something. One of the other villagers on Alpset is Sturgeon's granddaughter, I think.
Oh, the girl with the pot?
Pot?
Yeah, Sue Bell. I'm pretty sure it's her name, and I'm pretty sure it's his granddaughter, not the daughter. But maybe that has something to do with it.
Love has a funny way of doing that to people. Just double check. Yeah, Sue Bell. Props to you for remembering that name.
I did not remember the name. I actually just checked and looked it up. But I did remember the character.
Yes, that is important.
Because a lot of NPCs in Wind Waker, I don't think you can even learn their names in the game unless you were to look at an official guide, because the names don't show up in their speech bubbles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In future games, all you get is the dialogue boxes. Unless, well, no, you could probably get the name by taking them to the Nintendo gallery, which would explain why I don't know, because I never did the Nintendo gallery.
Yep, that would do it.
This is all making sense, man. One big full circle.
The only other way you would possibly be able to know a character's name is if it's spoken by someone else in the dialogue. Right. New theory. theory amendment.
Is this the theory about why no one says anybody's names?
No. It's backstory for Sturgeon. So I think we have a real Admiral Bobbery situation, right? So walk with me. Sturgeon, Orca, out adventuring. Sturgeon, back home, wife and kid. As they're out at sea, an illness strikes Sturgeon's wife. She passes away while he's out at sea. He comes back. It's just Sue Bell. And he vows to never go back out to sea again.
About as good as I could come up with, so yeah.
I love it.
There it is.
It's got the right motivation. It's got a good amount of tragedy. Perfect. Headcanon established.
Or I guess Sue Bell is his granddaughter. So.
Well, that just means that both children, son/daughter, and their spouse died in the illness.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, we have it. It's the same one that took Link and Errol's parents.
The great outset plague.
This illness is oddly age specific.
Oh my gosh. It all comes together. The great outset island disease plague.
Oh. Ooh. This is good.
Do they go into lockdown too?
I mean,
well,
I don't think they really ever leave that island anyways.
Yeah, plus there's so few people. It's not like it can't really spread all that much. It already did its damage.
Yeah.
Pandemics involve enough people to spread it.
Crazy how we got here from talking about old cranky man on the balcony.
Yeah, this was quite the direction.
This is a great journey. That's what we're here for. We're here for journeys.
I'm looking at the image. How does he get up there? Because there's no door. That's a window.
There's a ladder, I think, somewhere. Because Link
There's a ladder that goes to the door, but there's not one that explains how he unless he's able to open the window.
That's a wooden lattice. There's no opening that, I think. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, he definitely didn't squeeze through. That head is way too big.
Yeah, that's true. He jumped. He's a skilled warrior. He can jump.
He's spry.
I'm sure.
Well, thank you so much, Aaron Talen, for opening up to this page of the Bomber's Notebook. And we're going to head on over to Tingle's Maps, the series in which we explore the endless lands of Hyrule in search of our favorite places in The Legend of Zelda. And this month, our journeys have taken us to the most recent addition to The Legend of Zelda series, that is Echoes of Wisdom, and the first dungeon in Echoes of Wisdom, Suthorn Ruins. There's no official pronunciation for anything. Suthorn sounds as good as anything else.
It'd be Southern Ruins, right?
It's in the south of the map, so yeah, that checks out.
Southern, I just went with the pun, so Southern, Suthorn.
Well, the King's attendants are both General Right and Secretary Left. So I feel like it's
love them.
It's Minister Left, I think.
Minister Left.
Minister
with
Left.
An E.
I don't think they're past getting pretty on the nose with the with these naming conventions.
They know what they're doing.
And we have no complaints.
Heck no. In the Zelda series, we've had fire dungeons, we've had ice dungeons, water dungeons. Now we have our first official dirt dungeon.
They've had earth dungeons before.
Nah, this is a dirt dungeon.
Okay.
Not even rock.
There's a difference.
Just loose sediment and soil.
It's a lot of brown. Some green here and there, but we are playing in an anthill right now.
I was thinking about this before in the lead up to the podcast. Isn't this one of the only, like, one of two instances where you have to go back to a dungeon at some point in a game? Because in Skyward Sword, you have to go back to Skyview for the water quest. And then this one, you technically start out at the game where you play as Link and then free Zelda and you go back to this. Are there any other instances where you, like, it's mandatory that you have to go back to a dungeon?
The Forsaken Fortress? Wind Waker?
Yeah, that would count.
Yeah.
I guess.
That Forsaken counts. Four Swords Adventures, you have two separate quests that involve you going to Hyrule Castle.
Okay. Okay, so there are a few more than I even realized.
Though you already touched on what I wanted to start off with, the fact that we started the game here, in this dungeon. Which means, how petrified do you think Zelda is having to come back to this place?
That's a very good point.
She was kidnapped, she was imprisoned here, she just saw, like, this random hero attempt to save and suddenly disappear into nothingness, and then she has to flee for her freaking life from this embodiment of just a black hole chasing after her, and now it's she walks in. Oh no.
How many people do you think played Echoes of Wisdom and, like, going into it didn't realize that Zelda was the protagonist? Like, had no idea about any of the pre-marketing, anything like that, and they only realized it in that first cutscene.
Well, considering that the box art has Zelda at the forefront.
I mean, sure, but you still don't know that. Like,
I guess. I don't know.
There's got to be some people out there who are just never online, never looked at anything before the game came out.
At least 10.
At it's least
safe number, at least 10, because maybe people got it as, like, a gift and they someone booted it up for them and they weren't paying attention.
Fair enough.
Every Zelda game is at least somebody's first Zelda game. There's at least one person in the world who every new Zelda is their first Zelda ever.
Mm-hmm.
We were having that conversation. What was it, like, a couple of months ago, where, gosh, I forget who it was, but their child was not interested at all in playing Link's Awakening. But when she saw Echoes of Wisdom, you play Zelda's like, okay, I'll play this now.
Yeah. And that's only going to become more and more common as the years go by.
Mm-hmm.
I love Echoes of Wisdom.
Me too, man.
Southern Ruins is in a unique position as far as like dungeons go, because we start the game there and we see, as far as we know, Ganon, big pigman Ganon, just chilling in a random tutorial dungeon. I'm just really curious, like, I want to see Link's adventure prior to this. I want to see how Zelda got captured. It's such an interesting position as a dungeon, because it's also like the tutorial dungeon, but it's also like, oh, there was a Ganon fight here. That feels kind of important.
There is a really cool thing we see it in Zelda a lot, where we are given just enough details about something that did occur at some point, whether it's in recent history or in ancient history, and we can't help but wonder why. And I think something that is underappreciated about that is the fact that we're never told why or what happened before. It is just, here is this thing. We're going to give you some references. Shadow Temple and Ocarina of Time is the first thing I always turn to with this, because it's like Hyrule's bloody history of greed and hatred. Like, what the heck happened? What war crimes did Hyrule commit? Holy cow. But we don't know. And we're never told. And so we're just left to wonder and marvel at something that we're never going to get. And there's a lot of people who don't seem to realize the benefits of not having a full story to everything. There's a benefit to having things unexplained.
Another example I can think of in that regard is like where are the Gerudo in Twilight Princess? I think that's more of like a series thing rather than just a Twilight Princess thing, because at that time the Gerudo weren't as widespread as they are now, or at least like they weren't as prominent as a Zelda peoples as they are now. It wasn't until, I think, Breath of the Wild that they really got some sort of prominence, I believe.
They show up in Four Swords Adventures. Ocarina, Majora, Four Swords Adventures, and then Breath. But they have...
Doesn't Spiritrex have a character who's... I don't know if they're referred to as a Gerudo in the game.
Phantom Hourglass and Spiritrex has Jolene, who is very similar in design.
Okay, but she's never like even mentioned in official like art or official lore as a Gerudo.
As far as I'm aware, no. Uh-huh. That's never like officially confirmed.
Or even like a descendant or something like that.
I think we mostly just have to kind of draw our conclusions of here's the design. She looks very Gerudo-esque.
Right.
So there's probably something kind of like how. I know some people have made the same association with Telma.
Being Sheikah or Gerudo?
It's usually an implication in one direction or the other. I hear Gerudo more than Sheikah.
I do vaguely remember some theories about that years ago.
I don't think it's exactly the same, but I think it was pretty similar with people like headcanoning Groose as a progenitor of like the Gerudo or something.
Which I never understood, personally.
I've never even heard of that theory.
I think it was just because of the hair, and I think... Hold on, I gotta search for an image of Groose.
What, him being a womanizer? Like, is that...
Now, he's not a womanizer. He had eyes for one person. She just did not care for him at all.
Yeah, and why do you think that is?
Because he's Gaston? Who's a womanizer? Never mind.
I think it was just his hair and eyes, and that, I guess, his role in the final act of the game just felt too important. He must have been, like, a Ganondorf ancestor or something like that. I don't know. I don't know where the theory came from. I didn't say I prescribed to it, personally, but I've heard it here and through the grapevine.
Oh, so many different minds in this community.
Hey.
So many different minds.
We love theories. We love the theories.
Theorizing is fine. You just need to be aware of the flaws in your own theories and everyone is willing, is fully capable of putting how much weight into those theories as they want. Not all theories are created equal. Not all theories are viable.
I have a theory.
Go on.
Dirt Temple was actually like a long time ago, probably one of the was probably like an important not brown building in the middle of the forest.
That's a bold theory. Not really.
So I gotta be honest, I always pronounce it as Suthorn Ruins, and after this I can never go back to that. I'm always just gonna say Southern now because of you two.
You're welcome.
Suthorn.
This is what we do. We educate. I don't know if this is education, but we have changed minds today.
If learning's happening, then it's education. I am a teacher.
There you go.
Going back to the Dirt Temple. It does make me really happy that Echoes of Wisdom expanded the borders of the Into the Past / the Between Worlds Hyrule. So we get all these new regions that fit really comfortably in that prior previously established kingdom. Mm-hmm. I'm really impressed with how they were able to accomplish that.
It didn't take much for them to do it either. It was just, oh, we have these significant things that are not present in the current map. Let's just put them where they would go naturally, and there we go. And it fits. Mm-hmm. It's so nice. Well, thank you so much, Zach Freckin Smith, for bringing out this piece of Tingle's Maps. So we shall progress to the feature of the month. And for this month, Jeff, you have started to broach the topic as something that I have heard being discussed in similar veins, though from a different perspective than The Legend of Zelda. I was trying to find it. I could not pull it up. It was an interview from, I think, a director or something from Square, I want to say. And they were expressing concern about the challenges with trying to obtain and maintain new players to a long-running franchise like Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest, because the amount of time that it takes to develop a game on the scale of a Dragon Quest, or to put it in Zelda terms, Breath of the Wild, takes, you know, 7-8 years to complete. And, well, in the world that we live in, 7/8 years is an eternity. But you have provided a very simple solution to this problem, one that flies directly in the face of what seems to be everybody's opinion about what needs to happen with any sequel ever, which their argument is you gotta have it be bigger, it's gotta be better, and more features than ever before. Your argument is
Nintendo just needs to think smaller.
Okay, there we go. End of podcast. Everybody have a good day. No,
oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were about to go on with something. I apologize. But
that was an exquisite. Sorry, that was an exquisite like pass the baton moment. I was taking it in.
I was just enjoying the comedic timing. It was great.
I mean, it's been a topic ever since Breath of the Wild came out, though, because for as hugely popular as Breath of the Wild is, there remains a segment of Zelda fans who don't necessarily need the sheer size and scale that came with open world Zelda. They still yearn for that, for the linear story, the more structured story, like campaign, gameplay scenarios and whatnot. And begs the question, how does Nintendo try to appease both audiences? Because they're not going to just outright abandon open world Zelda. I mean, listen, I prefer pre-Breath of the Wild Zelda, but it makes no commercial sense for Nintendo to just outright abandon the size and the principles of freedom that came with the era of the Wilds games. Those aren't just going away anytime soon. Whatever the next 3D Zelda looks like, it's going to look a lot like them, even if it, you know, has its own identity, and even if it does lean a little bit more into the design choices of pre-Breath of the Wild games. Just bears the question then of how does Nintendo continue making games that are also able to please longtime Zelda, Legend of Zelda fans who want, you know, the linear story, the traditional dungeons. And in my opinion, it was, yeah, just think smaller. But thinking smaller isn't necessarily just making 2D games. I feel like now game design has come to a place where you could probably make a small-scale 3D Zelda game. One that feels somewhere in between the 2D Zeldas and the open-world Zeldas.
Speaking as somebody who has no experience in game design, my first thought of how does one create a game, I lean more towards story. What kind of story do you want to tell? I know that Zelda does not have that being the first question that they ask, generally. It is a question of what kind of mechanic or what kind of theme do we want to focus this adventure around? And so with Breath of the Wild, that was the theme that they went for, was exploration and freedom to go wherever you want, whenever you want. And they're able to craft a setting and a story that fits that very, very well. So if they want to work with that kind of perspective, let's go with a theme involving something that doesn't require something so massive, and instead maybe something that is a little more personal. Majora's Mask, to me, is an excellent example of something like this, where the theme, honestly, is time and the running clock, as well as the existential dread of the end. And that is expressed beautifully in that game as everyone is trying to deal with the end in their own terrified way. And so that becomes certainly a direction that they could go into. The amount of exploration that you're allowed to have is, it's not just freedom, open world, and linear railroad. There's so much more that you can do on that spectrum. And it's a spectrum that Zelda has played with repeatedly. Everything from as linear as Skyward Sword to Breath of the Wild, every game in there is in between in some kind of function. Heck, Skyward Sword isn't even the most linear game in the franchise.
No, it's not. And I have actually argued that, like, there's times where there's very meaningful exploration in Skyward Sword. Like, the game never outright tells you how to wake up Levios, for example. You kind of have to figure out the whole pumpkin soup thing for yourself. There's the section in the Lanayru province early in the game where you have to figure out how to progress past that first area, like lining up the elemental symbols. The game doesn't outright tell you that. There's a few different moments where the game really doesn't give you a whole lot of direction. You just have to figure it out for yourself.
When I imagine people talk about like linearity, specifically with the Zelda games, and I'm also like I prefer the, you know, prior to the era of the Wild Zelda games. I still like the Wild games, but I'm much more of a, you know, I like having, you know, let me go in an orderly fashion, and I kind of get overwhelmed with when I have too much freedom.
No, you like structure.
Yeah,
I do too.
Yeah. what I imagine people talk about when they say like, oh, linearity bad in Zelda is not having much to do outside of main progression, like not having any hidden grottos to jump into, or not many side quests or towns beyond Skyloft, or like that kind of stuff. And I think that's why Skyward Sword gets most of the brunt of that, is because there's not many avenues to explore out away from the main campaign and then come back to do the campaign. I'm not saying I agree with those. I think that's what I'm thinking, that most of that guides most of the ire from the public.
You remind me of A Link to the Past's setup, where you are given a map, which is a massive improvement from what we had in the first two games, and you are given markers on that map telling you where you should head next. Oh, you should go to Kakariko and talk to the Elder to get more information about this stuff. You get there, and his wife is, he's not here right now. He didn't tell me where he's going. I'm sure someone in town knows. And so you start talking to people in town, trying to figure out where the Elder went. If you're paying attention, nearly everybody in that town is like, hey, you know, I heard about this thing. If you go over here, there's a beautiful woman behind a waterfall. You know, if you want to go check that out, that'd be pretty cool if you saw that, right? Things like that. And so you're given these little hints to, ooh, I should go check that out sometime. And then you do, and you discover the Waterfall of Wishing. Oh my gosh, here's this cool thing! You learn about the Zoras that way. All of this kind of stuff gives you an indication of, this is stuff I could go out and discover on my own. Complete freedom of expression. And yet, you also have a pretty darn linear direction in the main story. You need to go to this dungeon, this dungeon, this dungeon. Even if it doesn't overtly tell you that that's the order, you're forced into doing Eastern Palace, Desert Palace, Tower of Hera. That's how it is. The crystals in the Dark World are literally numbered to tell you which way to go. And yet, you can still go anywhere you want. It's perfectly fine. And heck, you're rewarded for it.
Something that Echoes of Wisdom and Link Between Worlds do, which a lot of people, for some reason, forget about Link Between Worlds. That kind of makes me sad. But Link Between Worlds did it first. And that's like having a mix of open and linear in terms of progression, where you have your intro dungeon, and then you can do the next two in any order. And then you go to Hyrule Castle for the midpoint, do the Master Sword, get to Hyrule Castle. And then the third section of the game, you have more options to go. You have more options, and then you have the finale. Echoes of Wisdom does the same thing, where you have the intro set of dungeons. You have the starter dungeon, the Southern Ruins, Suthorn Ruins, the Dirt Temple. And you have the other two, the Desert Palace and Zora Palace? Water Palace?
It's Jabu Jabu's. I forget the names. It's not the Desert Palace.
Gerudo Palace. Gerudo Temple.
Basically, it's the still world in both. We're fine. Yeah. We know what we're talking about.
They have names. The desert one and the water one. And then you go to the Hyrule Castle for the midpoint section. And then after that, you have the next set of dungeons and then the finale. So there is that progression, that linear progression, still have some openness inside of it. And I think that would be a really cool approach to a 3D Zelda game, working within 3D space, taking that same exact structure and putting it into a 3D Zelda. Keeping it still maybe smaller scale, right? So we're talking about lowering development times and stuff. Making it a smaller scale, but still making it a 3D Zelda game in the lines of Majora's Mask.
My exact words in my feature were, funny enough, Echoes of Wisdom succeeded as a classic Legend of Zelda entry simply by finding a cozy middle ground between classic and open world approaches to the series. And that's exactly what it does. Like you said, there's a few different points in the story where you can go to whichever dungeon you want in any order. Echoes of Wisdom, for all its structure to its story and its, you know, traditional dungeons, it has so many different options for the player as to how they want to go about that. You know, obviously the Echoes, which there are well over 100, and every player has their own unique set that they use throughout the game, the ones that they preferred, ones that they never even touched. But then after that, you've got the automatons, you've got sword fighter mode, you've got the smoothies and the elixirs that you can make, you've got the accessories. There's many, many different elements of freedom in the game that obviously take a little bit, that, or just kind of feel a bit like the Era of the Wilds games in that sense. And yet, the Echoes of Wisdom is decidedly a classic Legend of Zelda game. It's known as a classic Legend of Zelda game, yet you still have so many different elements of freedom in there.
127 echoes, to be precise. And everyone gets an opportunity to use the echoes that fit them best. And it's really entertaining because you experiment. There are ones that you just, yeah, this one feels right, and you use this one. And then there may be a point where you're saying, well, this is the one I like, but it's not working. I gotta pivot and try something else. And that creates a lot of opportunities for exploration and for just making the game your own. And in this, I will praise Tears of the Kingdom's mechanics in the fact that the fusion ability gives a person the ability to, especially with all the Zonai devices, create whatever their imagination allows them to. And it's a brilliant way for them to be able to do that. And it makes me a little worried that maybe if Nintendo is thinking that we're all expecting something similar, we're going to end up with the same problems. Tears of the Kingdom is my primary example of what happens when you try and put too much into a game. And we don't need to get into all of the criticisms that we can have about Tears of the Kingdom. It's an amazing game. Every game has its flaws. But when you try and do it, so like, oh, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, 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 that, the freedom of expression suddenly becomes a little bit of a slog. If we want to take Echoes of Wisdom as another example, I do not use any of Dompei's creations, ever.
I never once used the automatons.
Me neither.
Likewise, yeah, never even nope. Touched them.
I don't even know how they work. I pulled one out for the one kid that wants to see a unique Zol, and that's it.
Yep, I never used them in combat at all.
I wish there were just more options, like in maybe interactions, special interactions between the automatons and some certain echoes, maybe. That would be cool. But I just had no reason to ever use them over, like, my Boomerang Moblin or Darknut.
I swore by the Wizrobes, Wolfos, and Darknuts as far as, like, combat. Or and also Caramadillos. Caramadillos were so good, especially really? In the first half of the game. Yep.
I just finished replaying it, and I discovered that sword moblins are amazing.
Being able to, and that's what I love about this game so much, is basically like a monster collector, like any monster collector game.
Yep.
you as soon as you drop, once you understand that, as soon as you drop an attack monster, as soon as you like echo it, it will do its attack like immediately. So you can like drop it. Attack and then recall, drop it, attack, recall. You can also just like drop it, bind it, and then just move them around and just swing for you. Like it's
Brilliant. I didn't think about
that's
that.
That's another thing. A lot of people forget about binds uses in the game. Like obviously there are puzzles where it's you have to use it to progress, but like a lot of people forget how many different applications there are to bind. Like a lot of people don't realize that in the final fight against Null, what you're supposed to do as Zelda is use bind to tear off his arms. Mm-hmm. So many people did that fight and just said, oh, Zelda just stands there the whole time summoning echoes, which you can do. But what the game wants you to do is use bind to tear off his arms.
I was spending most of my time just running away from everything. Yeah. I got just freedom. Okay. Attacks. Kill. Don't grab me.
So there's just another element of choice in Echoes of Wisdom on top of everything else that we mentioned before.
It was during this last playthrough that I realized that you can, just like you were saying, ripping off the arms, you can bind enemies and move them around. It's like, get out of my way.
Drop them off a platform.
Right. Yes.
Or in lava.
Good times.
With Tears of the Kingdom, I think, and going back to what I was talking about earlier with, I struggle with options overload. I think there's a lot of freedom for freedom's sake with not really much application for it. So that does kind of make me concerned, and that's why I really want like more. I don't need like an 100% linear like Final Fantasy 16 story. I don't need that, but just linearity in certain aspects. For example, the Dragon's Tears in Tears of the Kingdom. Why am I getting spoiled by choosing to do this Dragon's Tear over that Dragon's Tear? Oh, right?
Don't even get me started on that.
I said we weren't going to get into it. Remember?
I'll make it quick.
I'm just seething thinking about the fact that they didn't protect the player from being able to see cutscenes out of order.
And so that's why, like if you put linearity in that specific aspect, like okay, have Impa when you're in the Forgotten Temple tell you, okay, it seems like there's a specific order for these, that there's a story being told here, or just have it to where you see the first one, you have to, and it unlocks the second one to see somewhere else in the kingdom.
Right, they're not all on the overworld at the same time. Yep.
Like that.
That's what they should have done.
That's what I need. And also, just like, if it's not going to be like a scaled difficulty for dungeons, maybe you just give some sort of explicit order. Hey, if you want to give this any order, that's fine. But it seems like there's supposed to be an order. For, like, I don't know. Make the writing good, because what I just said wasn't a good example. But,
make the writing good. I love it.
Yeah. Period. Right.
Great advice.
I don't know, but like, I think there's just ways to add linearity and not just have freedoms for the sake of having freedom. And I think freedom and options get conflated together a lot, and I'm guilty of that, doing that too. But yeah, it's. There needs to be a balance in these hypothetical small scale games, but also I think in the big ones, right?
The other thing in regards to the size of 3D Zeldas, it's more than just, you know, appealing to fans of both styles of Zelda. It also really, it has a financial background as well with it, in the sense that, like, as Connor mentioned earlier, with Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest games taking too long to make, you know, with 3D Zelda, we're at a point now where, I mean, it's a 5-6 year development cycle for these games. And they're only going to get bigger and more, they're going to require more resources to develop. So Nintendo doesn't want Zelda to be sitting there with a 5-6 year gap for every 3D Zelda game, which is, you know, where they get spin-offs or remakes, but you can only do so many of those. So at a certain point, they're going to have to figure out a way to get smaller scale Zeldas out there in order to fill out the schedule for their release schedule, but then also to keep Zelda at the forefront of the public eye and for fans to, you know, keep it on their mind. They don't want fans to forget about Zelda at any point. There was a really good article that came out a few months back for automaton.com, where it was, I believe it was Japanese fans on Twitter were speculating that series like Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy, fans may not be developing, or younger fans, I should say, aren't developing the same attachment to those series as, like, say, we did growing up, because you're not seeing so many new games come out and you're seeing such long gaps between the new entries. You know, like with us who grew up playing Zelda, between Ocarina of Time and Twilight Princess, that was 4 different games that came out in a span of 8 years. Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, Wind Waker, Twilight Princess. 4 brand new landmark 3D entries. We got those in 8 years. For the Switch era of Zelda, you got 2, if that. You got, you know, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom. Obviously, there were some delays with Tears of the Kingdom related to the COVID-19 pandemic that could not have been avoided, but it's you know, we're not going to see the next 3D Zelda in 2027. Probably we may not even see it in 2028, so you're going to have another 4-5 year gap at minimum for that next game.
And even in that Ocarina of Time to Twilight Princess time frame, there are still that's only the 3D games. There are still,
right,
like, the Oracle games, and you know, they had that split market. And yeah, we have been getting like some remakes and a couple spin-offs here and there. But yeah, the dev cycles are only getting bigger as time goes on. It's really unfortunate. I'm hoping, I don't want Zelda to fall into the, it's mostly spinoffs and a mainline game here and there, but I feel like I think we could do for some spinoffs, if not the smaller scale adventures, like full on mainlines, but some spinoffs here and there. I'm thinking like, you know, you mentioned in the article, Cadence of Hyrule, maybe just outsourcing the IP to some trusted people.
Did either of you guys by any chance play Bayonetta Origins on the Switch?
I did not.
It's super cute. I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Oh, it's a wonderful game. And I like the whole time I was playing it, I felt like this could be a small scale 3D Zelda. Like this whole setup, the camera view, the amount of detail in the environments, the puzzle solving, the whole thing just felt like if they had 3D Zelda, but gave it to a little bit smaller studio and told them, you know, hey, you don't need 4 to 5 years to make this game. That is, I think, a great example of a 3D Zelda that could be made in just a couple of years, like maybe outsource it to a different studio, you know, someone outside of Nintendo, but have that to fill out the release schedule and to continue giving us Zelda products as we wait for these, you know, huge 3D entries.
This is a question of development. What takes the most time in creating something like Breath of the Wild?
I think it's, you know, testing. Aonuma, I believe, was the one who said the last year for Tears of the Kingdom was just all testing for bugs and glitches, especially in regards to like the Ultra Hand mechanic. They're just like polish.
So if that's the case, and the major thing they have to worry about is making sure that everything they've thrown into the game works as intended, the primary way then to cut down in time is to not have as many mechanics, or at the very least not have one as complex as Ultra Hand ended up becoming. So something like a old school Zelda adventure may actually be everything that we need. We don't necessarily need to have a brand new set of unbelievable abilities with every single Zelda incarnation. We love just having our bow and arrow, our hookshot, our boomerang. These are fun things. Even if we are not getting a groundbreaking technological achievement with every Zelda game, we can still enjoy the time that we spend. All we need is Hyrule, the tone of the Zelda adventure, a good companion, and a fun story to keep us invested.
I do wonder if Nintendo moves on from those kind of mechanics for the next 3D Zelda game simply because, like, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, their identity is so rooted in those sandbox experimental gameplay mechanics. And if they continue doing that in 3D Zeldas where, you know, hey, the player can make all of these crazy contraptions, or the character can pull off all of these crazy physics-defying maneuvers, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom don't feel so special anymore then. They kind of lose that identity, and I don't think Nintendo ever wants that to happen with the Zelda games. When everything is big, nothing is big. Is the old saying.
You mentioned physics, and I think that for Breath of the Wild was their big thing was just they invented a brand new physics engine. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I could be misremembering. But I think that was the biggest spike in development was them just trying to like create this from the ground up physics engine with how the world interacts with itself, like rolling rocks down the hill and blowing up bomb barrels in a bokoblin camp. And then on top of that, in Tears of the Kingdom, as you said, with the Ultra Hand and all those possibilities building. I think a good way to cut down on time, and this applies to really any game or any series, is reutilizing resources, or reusing assets, rather. Obviously, you have the Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, and how that was developed in a year? Less than a year?
Correct.
Yeah.
Majora's Mask had 1 year for completion.
And it was peak. and just taking those things and recontextualizing it. And it also it helped because it was a whole parallel world scenario. But also Link's Awakening and Echoes of Wisdom, the remake and Echoes of Wisdom. I haven't looked at those assets in under a microscope, but I'm sure there are some reuses happening there. And so I'm thinking, like, could definitely just repurpose some things into a smaller scale adventure. If not even a spinoff or two here and there.
I'm reminded of a Pokemon. I'm reminded of Pokemon because everybody was always so upset. They keep reusing assets in Pokemon. And I never worried about that. Assets, whatever.
Yeah.
But the reason it made me think about that, because in a similar vein, I recently finished Pokemon Legends ZA. And the entirety of that game takes place in one location, one city. Which is really weird when Pokemon is known for traveling across an entire landscape with a bunch of different environments and all the different Pokemon there. And most people would call that a major departure from the usual Pokemon formula, regardless of whether or not you think that the formula needs to be tweaked anyway. I have so many thoughts on that, but this isn't a Pokemon show. What it ended up doing that I adored was the fact that since everybody was in this one location, there was an excuse for people to make repeat appearances. You didn't go to one gym leader, fight the gym leader, and then you'd never see the gym leader again. You had a challenger. You fought that challenger. Okay, you won. You moved to the next ranking. But they're still around. They still have stuff they want to do. So when things start getting a little bit more complicated, suddenly they've been invited to the same thing you've been invited to. It's like, oh, hi again. Yeah, I don't know why we're here. We got this crap going on because of this person. And then, oh, no, I'm involved in this. And this person that you fought before, they're like my best friend. And so they come in and they're talking about something or other. It creates this great... It's a network that's made that suddenly I have feelings towards these characters because I have a chance to meet with them over and over and over again. With Tears and Breath, we don't get that opportunity all that much unless you want to count Addison, whom I want to strangle for having the worst advertising campaign and physics knowledge ever. But you don't get the same real opportunities to interact with characters and develop bonds with them and appreciate things that we got to have in Skyward, especially Majora's Mask, because a smaller environment means more meaningful, repeated interactions.
This was something I only kind of alluded to in my feature, because I try not to be super negative in anything that I write, but as far as spin-offs go, Nintendo absolutely needs to move on from Warriors games. We need something other than Hyrule Warriors for the next Zelda spinoff. Have some imagination again, for crying out loud.
I've been clamoring for a turn-based RPG with Zelda characters.
That is legitimately my most wanted Zelda product at this point now. I want that more than the next 3D game. Give me a Zelda game like Mario RPG, and I would be the happiest person in the world.
Oh gosh, imagine teaming up with Square to make a Zelda RPG. That'd be amazing.
Especially because RPGs, and just that whole design structure, you can still have so much of Zelda's essence in those. Like a few years ago, I wrote a piece when Paper Mario, the original, celebrated its 20th anniversary. And when you look at that game's design structure, it's so much like Zelda. Like, Mario's partners are basically Link's items. They all have a unique ability or feature that you use to solve puzzles inside dungeons, to reach places that you can't get to otherwise, to hit triggers and hit other items that are out of reach.
You also mention, as an example, Metroid, and as somebody who plays randomizers on a regular basis, you could totally make, I'm thinking something akin to another Zelda-focused game where Zelda's in some kind of maze, Metroid style, and she has to do whatever is necessary in there.
We could definitely do a Metroidvania Zelda, or just any kind of 2D Zelda. I think Zelda could definitely stand to return to a 2D perspective at some point. If you guys played the latest Prince of Persia game by any chance from a couple years ago, The Lost Crown, like that, the whole time I was playing that, similar to Bayonetta Origins, the whole time I'm playing that, it felt like a Zelda game just in a 2D Metroidvania perspective.
Something that I recently, and by recently I just mean in the past, like maybe 2 weeks, is with the advent of these two-player co-op adventure games like It Takes Two and Split Fiction.
Yes.
I think that would be a great multiplayer game. Also, multiplayer Zelda, like Four Swords Adventures, Triforce Heroes. I love those games. I will not be ashamed. I love Triforce Heroes. I will not be silenced.
That's perfectly fine. I love them too. I just need more friends to play them with.
I will say, Triforce Heroes was a perfectly fine single player experience. But like even then, even
it was okay.
I'll concede it was fine. It was a fine single player experience.
It had some flaws. It was obviously primarily made for multiplayer over single player.
Yes.
Anyway,
but I think like a two player co op adventure game, where you have to solve puzzles, do dungeons, trade and swap items here and there, left and right. I think that'd be a great thing to do. Also, a roguelike.
Sure.
I'm thinking Hades. You have the items, like the swappable items. You have the power-ups. The Zelda has a pretty solid range of magic and magic systems that could fit, obviously, with a turn-based RPG, but also like a roguelike or a 2D platformer like Metroid. I don't think they would... I'm not Nintendo, but I...
You're not?
I can't... I know. Crazy, right? I can't imagine they would cross genres like that, like turning Zelda into a 2D platformer.
What are you talking about? Adventure of Link.
I don't even get me started. But like even then, like I don't going full Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, or Ori and the Blind Forest, I can't really imagine Zelda doing that. I wouldn't be opposed to it. I think it'd be pretty awesome seeing Link or the Zelda characters in that sort of setting.
Another perspective they could use is like what's used in side-scrolling beat 'em ups, like, you know, Streets of Rage or the Dungeons and Dragons games from the 90s. The most recent example I referenced in my feature was Absolum, a really great indie roguelike beat 'em up that came out last year, where it's, you know, hand-drawn 2D graphics, but the plane of movement is a little deeper. The plane of movement goes back a little farther, so you're not just moving necessarily like on a flat horizontal line. You can kind of move into the depth of the environment a bit, and you have a bit more opportunity to like interact with different environmental features, attack enemies from different positions. Something like Absalom could easily recreate, you know, the towns, the dungeons of a Zelda game. And as long as you can get some of those core Zelda elements in there, like dungeons, interacting with NPCs, having towns to explore, you know, boss battles, anything like that, you can have a Zelda game that, even if it's not a traditional 3D or, you know, top-down adventure game, you could still have it feel like Zelda. I truly believe that a turn-based RPG could feel just like a Zelda game, as long as you have those elements that we mentioned before. Paper Mario, Mario RPG often felt like that to me.
The question of what feels like a Zelda game is something that keeps getting thrown around by people critiquing the Zelda games themselves. What feels like Zelda, which is always hilarious to me since they all feel like Zelda to me. And while some of the options that are being provided, I don't necessarily see right off the bat as being perfect fodder for Zelda, Hyrule Warriors feels like Zelda, oddly enough, somehow, despite the fact that it is mass murder, which is not how Zelda games play, usually. And so you can do that if you are willing to branch out. The question is how much is Nintendo willing to branch out? And that might be the flaw in this, in their position when it comes to this whole situation. They want to make sure that games are coming out on a regular basis so that fans are happy and the new fans are getting obtained and held on to. They want it to feel like Zelda, so that it's Zelda that they're attached to, but at the same time, if you're overly protective about what feels like Zelda, you might not get that other objective of having regular releases.
We're missing the obvious answer here, and that's make a Zelda fighting game.
Okay. Continue.
Castlevania tried that back in the Wii days.
That's
so
true.
Sonic did.
Look how well that turned out. look at how well it turned out for both of them.
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Hey, we're getting a new Castlevania game finally, so that's something at least.
At the very least, as we wait for you want a way for Zelda to be at the forefront of people's minds. Actually, talk about Zelda, Nintendo.
That's one way to do it.
Yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
Happy 40th, Nintendo! If you want to say something.
We're going to get news in July. Trust the process.
Man, I hope you're right. So bad.
Well, regardless of when we are waiting for the next Zelda game, if you want to continue to have Zelda in your life, we have 40 years of The Legend of Zelda to look back on and enjoy. For some of us, maybe experience for the first time. I hope that you will take the opportunity to take advantage of all of the means by which we have to experience this wonderful series as we wait and see just what is coming next. Caden, Jeff, thanks to the both of you for coming on once again.
Of course, always a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Great to have both of you here, and thanks to all of you once again for joining us. We try and do this once a month. And so we will see you in June as we experience more of our wonderful experiences in Hyrule and beyond. Hope to see you next time on the Zelda Universe podcast.